and streaming on the web since 1996, this is Cinematic Sound.
Hello again, I'm Jason Drury, welcoming you to another of the continuing series of film, TV and video game composer interviews on Cinematic Sound Radio. Chris Ballone is one of film music's premier mastering engineers. From his restoration of the FSM release I Spy the LPs, released in 2011, he has been in demand with film soundtrack labels to work on major film soundtrack releases. His list of album projects include Breakfast at Tiffany's, True Grit, his six-disc La La Land set of music from the TV series Mission Impossible, The Ten Commandments for Entrada, the 15-disc set of the music from the original series of Star Trek, and many more. In 2019, Chris Ballone was part of a team who helped restore John Williams' score for The Towering Inferno to its former glory, and also worked on the restorations of The Italian Job by Quincy Jones and won Goodwin's score for Monte Carlo or Bust. In September 2019 for Cinematic Sound Radio, I talked to Chris via Skype at his base at the time in Perth, Australia. In the first of his two-part interview, we talk about his first interests in recording and restoring film music, his relationship with the legendary Eric Tomlinson, and find out what exactly a mastering engineer does. And throughout both parts of the interview, we'll also be playing music from the wide catalogue of projects that have been expertly restored by Chris Ballone. Chris Ballone, how did your interest in music start?
I guess the word I would use for all this stuff is to say the word intersection. This is because I grew up in what I'd term a musical household, but it wasn't that my parents played musical instruments, and it wasn't really that even I played a musical instrument. I did take piano lessons in my primary school, but really not so much that. It was more that my parents were playing music. There was always music playing. And my father had, and he still has, a wide taste in music. So things from jazz to rock to classical to blues, lots and lots of albums, a massive amount of albums he's got, and even a few soundtracks. And when we think of things like soundtracks, we're talking the Star Wars double LP, we're talking some John Williams and the Boston Pops. Interestingly, a lot of Dave Grusin, and I think that came mainly from the GRP label that Dave Grusin started up with Larry Rosen. And that was a lot of Dave Grusin's jazz stuff came through on that. And some of the Sheffield Lab direct-to-disc cut LPs of the 70s, he was very much into that sort of stuff. So I guess continuing on this journey of intersection, the other element that comes into play is film itself. One thing that's kind of interesting about my background is that our family business transported the film cans, the spools of film, and this is back before things were digital, were actually on film, 35mm and sometimes 70mm film. They would transport that to the metropolitan cinemas, to the city cinemas. And that allowed us as a family to often get invited to sneak previews. So things that I can remember specifically, Under Siege 2, I remember that. I think that was the first Dolby Digital film. Alien 3, and the funny anecdote about that was the the weird and wonderful 20th century Fox logo that opens up Alien 3, how it starts in mono and it's kind of quiet, and then it balloons out to be this crazy thing and it starts to spread out to stereo. As that actually started in the cinema, it was very quiet and somebody actually yelled out, "Turn it up, turn it up." So I can remember things like that. Apollo 13 is another one that I remember. But then sort of continuing this idea of intersection, the family business also transported the local symphony orchestra. So what that did for me is that I actually got to see what an orchestra looked like, what it sounded like. And some of the first paid work that I did when I was studying at university was helping out my father and my uncle in transporting the orchestra to and from its performance venue. And so to do that job, you kind of need to know the layout of the orchestra. You need to know where all the instruments are, because you might be asked to go and fetch a timpani, or where you need to get the harp and we need to put it into the spot where the harp goes. So you actually need to know where all these things are positioned so that you can do your job properly. And then when we talk film music, it's all those things together. It's the music part, it's the film part, and it's the orchestra part. And I guess like most of our generation, it was the Star Wars film. It was the Star Wars soundtrack. It was that famous double LP. And it was watching that film, probably taped off TV on VHS, which is where I probably saw it the most. And the film on VHS was kind of the visual guide, but the soundtrack album was the oral guide to that galaxy far away. And it kind of did this double duty in my mind. It was the young person's guide to the orchestra as well. So that's how that all came about. It's that intersection of those various themes.
Yes, Star Wars opened the doors to film music to a lot of people. And I think, really, we wouldn't be talking today if it wasn't for Star Wars
Absolutely. And I think one of the interesting things about it is that it's a film where, if you want to be really brutal on it, you can say that it didn't do anything new. It was really the repackaging of a whole heap of ideas that had existed in film many, many years before. A whole heap of story kind of arcs that were well-trodden stories, a whole heap of ideas that were well-trodden. Even musically, John Williams kind of borrowing from that golden age swashbuckling sound. And it was just then modernized. It was the state-of-the-art special effects, state-of-the-art stereo sound. And it was this amalgam that just kind of happened to occur at the right place, the right time for everyone to lap it up. And as we say, it's still got the staying power that it does, because it's just this amazing combination.
Now, when did you decide to become an audio engineer?
I guess my interest in audio probably started about the time that I was in primary school, actually. It was playing around with our Technics cassette deck at home, and Dad had a portable Sony cassette recorder that he'd got from a family member who'd went to Japan. And I'd record sounds, I'd play records, I'd play CDs. And this is sort of just after the mid-1980s. We were fairly early adopters of the CD format. We had the CD by around then. And the first thing I did when we ended up with an IBM compatible PC at home was to start messing around with the rudimentary sound editing software, digital recording that was around at the time. And you needed a special specific paddle card that you'd put in your PC to do this. By the time I finished high school and was in university, I started studying computer science, and I was recording friends' bands. We'd often record things live to stereo or to four-track quarter-inch tape. And later we started recording some things digitally, but we'd certainly be editing digitally where we could. And this was all straight to stereo, so no remixing or anything like that. And whilst I was at uni, I was a host and a panelist for a radio program. And this is a few years before the station had switched across to digital. And as part of our show, we reviewed films and I talked about soundtracks. We did a comedy serial. We called it a comedy serial. It was kind of a radio serial that took the idea of a film such as Total Recall. And then one of my compatriots, Josh, he would take the story of Total Recall and some of the exact dialogue of it, and he would rework the story into something that had the same characters and even some of the same lines of dialogue, but kind of a completely different story. And then we would voice it out with our own voices, and then we would try and lay in sound effects that made sense and music cues from the film that were appropriate to do so.
So McBain goes to Recall and requests proprietor Bruce McLean's 10% frontal lobotomy discount.
So what's in the lobotomy package?
Well, Doug, when you go Recall, you go first class. You think you flew to Mars in the best seat in the luggage compartment. Not only that, you'll enjoy the finest one-star accommodation and travel around in a postal delivery van dropping off interplanetary mail.
Sounds idyllic.
But alas, things go awry in the first phase of the lobotomization process.
Hey Bruce, we're losing him. He's showing all the traits of a deranged postal worker.
So what?
I haven't put in the Berkowitz routines yet.
Oh jeez, I'm having a really bad day.
They hastily dig out the part of McBain's brain devoted to memory, careful to leave in the bit that stops him becoming a drooling vegetable. A week later, McBain leaves Recall and runs into some of his old construction worker buddies. They don't seem quite the same anymore.
Why are you guys wearing postal uniforms?
And that was all done through a combination of analog and digital technology. And it was kind of the perfect time, as I saw it, to learn the craft of working in analog and also digital. And this is kind of a conglomeration, I suppose, of professional, semi-professional, consumer gear that was used apart through this journey to actually do it. So earlier we were talking about the intersection of things, and this is kind of now adding another element to it. It's saying it's music, it's films, it's orchestra, it's audio, it's technology. And I guess it's that combination that's allowed me to get into this stuff. And how I actually got into it was writing to Lucas Kendall and writing to him in, I think it was 1998. And I had this crazy idea that I knew what I was doing enough to take a copy of Battle Beyond the Stars and Humanoids from the Deep, two classic James Horner scores, only on vinyl at the time. And I thought, here we go. I can make this sound good. I can get rid of all the pops and ticks by manually editing them out. And I thought, I'll send him a CDR of this in the hope that he could put this out on Film School Monthly. It was as bold and brazen decision as that. And I think he said, you know, thanks, but no thanks, and all that sort of stuff, very polite and courteously. But it wasn't until another 10 years or so had passed that we reconnected. And it was, again, me writing to him and saying, is there anything I can do? I'll help do something pro bono just to prove myself. I'm really interested in all this stuff. I'm really interested in film scores. What can I do to help was my question. And I guess I did a few things for him, and that was just slowly but surely. And then eventually we just did a bit more and a bit more. That's how it all got started.
Did you ever remind Lucas of the tape?
No. Well, look, it probably came out 10 years later or something. And I seem to recall it was still had to come from vinyl, but James Nelson did the mastering at the time, and he's a very good engineer and he did a great job of it. So he probably did a lot better job of it than I certainly did. I wouldn't profess that my version of it is any good. I haven't listened to it since, but it's probably terrible by today's standards. But there you go. You've all got to start somewhere, don't you?
Would you still have it?
I would still have it somewhere. I should dig it out. It'd be on a CDR somewhere in a drawer. Look, I've certainly still got the LPs. I've got them. What was actually great about them at the time was that they were both sealed. I happened to find both albums on the same day from the same place, and they were sealed. They'd never been played before. So the only time I'd initially play them was to transfer them across to digital and then start to do cleanup, which took me days and days, nights and nights it was of work.
Now, did you have any formal training to become a film music mastering engineer?
No. So as I said, my background was one of computer science. So I studied a computer science degree. That didn't involve any training in audio. Although, look, it's fair to say that when I was doing my student radio work, there was training as part of the radio station to operate equipment that was needed there. But otherwise, it was just very much make things up as you go, learn things as you go, see what's possible. And to a degree, I think that's an important lesson we can all take about anything in life. It's like, well, just have a try, see what you can do, see what you can't do. Try and push something in a way that maybe it's not intended to be done, and see what you get. And sometimes things happen that are kind of amazing, but other times it's all rubbish. But you know, you get to know, you get a feeling for what works and what doesn't. The greatest compliment I think to any editor of anything, whether it's editing a novel or editing a screenplay or editing a film or editing audio, is whether or not you can hear the edits. One of the interesting things here, I think, to touch on is it's that idea of practice. And there's an author called Malcolm Gladwell. Well, he was the guy that came up with the notion that you spend 10,000 hours on something and you can master it. And whilst you could agree or disagree with aspects of that, the idea that he was saying is that if you spend enough time doing something, you should end up being pretty good at it. And I think that's true of anything that we do in audio or even anything in life, is that if there's a challenge in front of you, if there's an opportunity to practice, if there's an opportunity to improve, then I'm all for it. And it doesn't matter if it's audio or anything. I just enjoy the idea of trying to do something new, different, improve essentially from what I'd done before.
So as you said, you got your break by emailing Lucas Kendall and finally he relented and he gave you some work. Can you remember the first bit of editing you did for Lucas and Film School Monthly?
The first thing that I worked on for Lucas was the I Spy album that he did, where he had the Earl Hagen I Spy soundtracks, the two different LPs that he put on the one CD. And I worked on one of those LPs where I did a bit of restoration, I suppose we would call it these days, and some fixes to that, and then sent it to him and it went to Doug Schwartz for mastering. We'll be right back.
That was music from I Spy, Volume 2 of the LPs, music from the classic 1960s Spy series, starring Robert Culp and Bill Cosby, with music composed by L. Hagen, the first mastering engineering job of my guest today, Chris Malone. My name is Jason Drury. Now, Chris, one of the great influences of your career, and probably your life, was the great Eric Tomlinson. Tell us how you met Eric Tomlinson, and tell us about your relationship with him.
I talked earlier about the idea that the Star Wars soundtrack album was kind of the young person's guide to the orchestra, as far as I kind of see it. Without realizing, at least initially, Eric Tomlinson was also part of that team that was part of the guide, along with John Williams, along with the LSO. He was there as well. And as we know, he recorded all the big John Williams scores in London at the time, the Star Wars saga, Superman, Dracula, Raiders, Monsignor, all those sorts of things. But going back as well to Jane Eyre and Fiddler on the Roof, he did them with John Williams. I'd also discovered that he did the early James Bond films, and in particular Goldfinger and Thunderball. And then later he did things like Alien and Aliens. So as a young collector, most of my soundtracks were kind of by chance actually Eric Tomlinson recordings. And for me, I'd always wanted to be a scoring mixer when I was younger. I thought that the notion of sitting at a mixing console and balancing all of these different sounds of the orchestra was just an amazing idea to me, that it could even be done, but then something that I really wanted to do. I charted my professional career as one of learning computer science because I was actually given some bad advice by somebody who was working in the industry at the time. And they said to me that they essentially saw no future in anything audio related, from film or television or music recording or anything like this, which, you know, we know is absolute rubbish, but this is coming from somebody that was the head of a TV station's audio department. And they were telling somebody who was 18 or 19 years old at the time, that was me, that this is the way they felt. And I figured that they were some authority on the matter, given their position. So I kind of changed my course as to what I was doing. But one day, out of the blue, I thought, you know what? I wonder if I can try and contact this Eric Tomlinson guy. And it was actually the late and talented David Wishart of Silver Screen Records who had said, hey, actually, Eric is still around. And I completely wrongly assumed that he'd long since passed on. So I put in an email to him. It was simple as that. I wrote him an email. And it was his wife, Joy, who responded and said that Eric would be interested in having a phone conversation. And I thought, wow, a phone conversation? This is really weird. Okay. So we organized this for mid-2005. I think it was July sometime. And as we talked, I learned more and more about the man, his craft, his recollections of working with the greats like John Williams and Jerry Goldsmith and Maurice Jarre. But what really struck me, and I'll never forget this, was just how humble and affable and easygoing and just how friendly he was as a person. And this amazed me because this was a guy who'd recorded Frank Sinatra's only album outside of the United States. But he was prepared to spend a couple of hours talking to essentially a nobody, a person who was 26, 27 years old, who had just out of the blue essentially contacted him and said that they had an interest in his work. So from that point on, we, and Joy, his wife, is really important in this as well. We stayed in touch pretty much on a monthly basis. And we all met for the first time in 2006. And this was face to face, and it was actually near Abbey Road Studios. And then in 2007, I was really honored, I guess, to stay with them, to stay in their house for a few days down in Devon. And I guess they kind of looked upon me as like a second son of sorts. They took such a genuine interest in me as a person, in kind of my work, my personal life, what I was doing. And they kind of really became mentors for me, both of them together. And for the rest of their lives, we very much had a lot of good conversations. And it was actually Eric who encouraged me to pursue the idea of audio work. He was the one behind that drive. He kind of saw some synergies between himself and me insofar that he didn't have any formal training himself in audio specifically, but he had a keen interest in it and he learned a lot of things just by listening. And he felt that that was kind of the same as me. And he felt the first hurdle for a lot of this stuff is to kind of show an interest in it. And if you're showing an interest in something, then that's the thing that is generally unlocks everything else. So he kind of saw his life and career as both ups and downs, I guess. And he would say the French phrase, c'est la vie, is something that would often be something he'd said. And it's kind of one of recognizing how life is, I suppose, that sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. But he didn't see it as a reason to kind of give up. And it was quite the opposite. He kind of saw it as a mantra to know when you should fight for something or you should really pitch in and try and achieve something that you want to achieve, but then also recognize the times when you do need to walk away, but to always kind of take the moral high road in doing that. I can remember that his kind of aspirational goal, I suppose, for me was to get me into Abbey Road. That was what he thought. And I kind of always laughed about that because I thought that was a completely ridiculous notion. But I think what he was trying to get to with that is the idea of saying, well, look, if you set yourself some sort of aspirational goals here, then at least you've got something to work towards. So I guess I saw a very special relationship come out of this time of knowing Eric and Joy. And it was one that started by knowing the work, growing up, literally knowing the work of the man, and then transforming into this idea of knowing the man, the person that was beyond the work, so that we spent most of our time when we were either together or talking together, talking about things that had nothing to do with film music and nothing to do with audio engineering. It was more about just people being people and really having a strong affinity for each other. So they were both superb people. They really were. And I think of them often and I do miss them because they were just really, really great people.
Did you ever work with Eric Tomlinson?
We didn't work together. I have actually worked on some of his scores, which has been interesting. I did Judith was one that he recorded. That was a Sol Kaplan score. And there are bits on that that are quite over-recorded. And it's that idea of the Vuvuzela thing that he did with John Williams, I think, was coming through in that, either deliberately or perhaps accidentally. But it's kind of interesting because this is around about the same time that then Sol Kaplan did those Star Trek original series scores where he did the Doomsday Machine, for example. And that has very much the same sonic character. It's not as memorable as the Doomsday Machine. I think the Doomsday Machine is just phenomenal because of its employment of the idea of the thematic approach, the leitmotif approach, where he's giving essentially every single element that you see on the screen has its own theme, and he's just cycling through that, whether or not it's the Enterprise or the Constellation or Kirk or the Doomsday Machine itself or the Transporter. He's got these themes for everything, basically. It's just an amazing idea.
We'll be right back.
That was music from the 1966 war drama Judith, directed by Daniel Mann and starring Sophia Loren, Peter Finch and Jack Hawkins, with original score composed and conducted by Saul Kaplan, recorded by Eric Tomlinson and remastered by Chris Malone. And Chris, during your discussions with Eric, did he talk about the relationship with the composers that he worked with?
I think what became clear about his collaborations is that he enjoyed all of them because he was that kind of guy. He was just able to be fun. He was able to be lighthearted. He was able to know that he needed to do the work and be professional and make sure that the sessions ran properly and didn't have any breakdowns or anything go wrong. But he knew that he could certainly celebrate the idea of a composer finishing their scores. And you've probably seen some of those behind-the-scenes photos from the Star Wars sessions where they're kind of having a bit of a jocular time at the end of the session. They're all having a bit of a drink and a cigar and that sort of stuff. So that's kind of how he was. He was one of very much building relationships with the composers. And through the idea of building the relationship, he was then able to kind of do, I suppose, what he and I were able to do, which was put the work to the side, so to speak, because the work was something that needed to be done. But the idea of getting to know the person meant that everything else would then start to flow around it. He certainly had a great time working with all the composers we would know, but then as time moved into the 1980s and when the Anvil Abbey Road Alliance ended up ending in the mid-80s, and he started going freelance and working with people like Basil Poledouris and Michael Kamen and all those guys of that kind of era, the younger composers at the time, he found them really interesting and fun people to work with. And I think the trick was that everyone had this mutual appreciation of each other's skill and capability. And certainly the stories that sort of came back from some of the people connected to his work was that they were just really thrilled that he could hear something once and he could deliver a live mix. And there was never any difficulty of having to spend hours and hours trying to get a balance. It was something that he was able to do pretty quickly. And the sessions ran pretty smoothly, generally speaking.
Yes, the range of composers that he worked with from the 60s onwards was astounding. I even recently found out that he even worked with Barry Gray on the television series UFO. He was like, he was everywhere.
I think it was Dan Wallen who once said that Eric Tomlinson was the most famous engineer in the world. And he kind of said that jokingly. And I know that Eric had spoken very fondly of Dan Wallen. They knew each other pretty well. That it was kind of this idea that for some reason Eric had done such a lot of well-known pieces. He'd been working on a lot of stuff, the James Bond films, the Star Wars films, all happened to be kind of at the right place at the right time with a lot of this stuff. The Frank Sinatra album I talked about earlier. So all of these things. And yet what's kind of sad, I suppose, for a lot of these engineers of the time, and even the ones prior to that, when you look at the ones that were working in the 50s, is that that information's kind of been lost to the sands of time. We don't know a lot of the engineers who recorded a lot of these things. You can think of the engineering team that was at 20th Century Fox on the Fox scoring stage. The names like Murray Spivack and Vinton Vernon and Douglas Williams and Ted Keep and then John Neal and finally Armin Steiner. There's probably others in there as well, but to kind of know which ones they recorded and whose projects they were assigned to, a lot of that is probably lost or at least is sitting in very few people's heads these days. So it's kind of nice when we can celebrate a recording by somebody when we know that they did it. That's, I think, a really nice thing to be able to find out and then to properly credit in the album notes when we do these things.
Have you met and talked to other recording engineers?
Look, I've had the good fortune of spending some time with Alan Snelly and John Richards. I've exchanged a few emails over the years with Dan Wallen, with Sean Murphy, with Dennis Sands. And look, I admire these gentlemen immensely. This, if you think of the talent, of the idea of being able to walk into a studio, to know where you're going to position all these microphones, what microphones you're going to use, how you're going to plug them into the mixing console, what kind of gain settings, we call it, that you're going to use, how you're going to patch this all through to a tape machine, how you're going to balance it and mix it all down. And this is all in an era where it was before computers, before the concept of things like Pro Tools and things that are common now. And it's just amazing that they were able to do that. I think it's phenomenal, an amazing talent. All of these people just have such an amazing talent to have been able to do that.
Right, now moving on, what exactly does a mastering engineer do?
I guess what I would do is kind of split that up into two parts. I would say, let's talk about restoration and then let's talk about mastering. And I think let's even prefix all that by the concept of the Hippocratic Oath, the Hippocratic Oath that's taken by medical doctors. This is one of the oldest creeds in history. And if you look at it, it's basically the notion of do no harm is what the Hippocratic Oath talks about. And in fact, one of the things that's in there is talking about preserving the finest traditions of my calling, is one of the things that it says. And why I'm talking about the Hippocratic Oath is because I think it also applies to what we do in audio work. So that finest traditions of my calling is kind of about, in my mind, the idea of respecting what made a recording special in the first place. So whenever we're doing restoration, which we'll get into in the mastering concept of it, it's kind of at least trying to hear things through the ears of the people in the room as they were doing it at the time. So perhaps trying to strip away the technology limitations that may have existed, but trying to understand what they might have been going for. But at the same time, the Hippocratic Oath talks about things like, I must not play at God. So the way I interpret that is, perhaps controversially, when we see these remixes from 24 or 48 track tape of scores where they're taking the discrete orchestral sections that each had a microphone and rebalancing that down to stereo for a CD, and we might end up with something that's quite a ways off what was originally intended. And in my mind, I like to try and stay as close to the original sound as makes sense to do. And I think sometimes we're playing at God a bit when we're remixing something when we don't need to. Sometimes we need to because there's no element that exists other than these multi-track tapes, but often there's a really good fill mix somewhere that we might be able to use. So that's one thing. But, you know, even things like tape hiss, that's a good example, because at one end, it kind of obfuscates the music when there's this hiss that's just so loud that it's kind of distracting. But if you take too much of it out, you end up obliterating the music. So it's a tightrope. And I guess what I'm getting to with all this stuff, without sort of getting into the detail of it at this stage, is the idea that we kind of need to uphold standards. And the way that we get to those standards, again, is this Hippocratic Oath. It's standing on the shoulders of those that have come before us. It's understanding what the people like Eric Tomlinson have done, what the mastering engineers of yesteryear, like Doug Sachs, and the current mastering engineers like Doug Schwartz, what those guys have done, and try and understand what might be applicable, what we can learn from them. So this kind of circles them back to, what are we actually talking about when we're talking restoration? And I guess it starts with having a good capture of the original element to digital. And if it's a digital recording already, then that's not so much of an issue. But if a lot of these things started in the analog domain, and a lot of them started on materials that through the ravages of time, through the chemical properties that they have deteriorated. And it's then the job of restoration to work in the digital domain, because I think that's the only way we can realistically do a lot of this now, and reinstate or reconfigure the sound to something that was there before the time process had been unkind to it. So I kind of see the job as, the phrase I'd use would be, saving the past from the future. The idea that we have these things that are important to us all as historical things that we should be preserving and we should be keeping for future generations who might want to enjoy them. So we need to do some work to make that happen. And it's kind of a science and it's kind of an art. It's both things together. The science is about things like tape hiss, fixing up some edits that might have been done in the analog domain that are a bit clunky. We can kind of massage them a bit more. We can do things like filling in dropouts, and that's where the sound drops away for a moment. We can do things now with what's called wow and flutter, which are the speed fluctuations that occur because of a medium that has gone through some uneven shrinkage and warping. We can fix those things now pretty well. And we can do things like what we call unpot. We can unpot volume fluctuations. So where we're dealing with an element where the volume goes up and down because it's what's been used against a film itself, we can work to reverse that kind of stuff. So I guess that's kind of the science-y type stuff. And then the art aspect of it is about mixing, if we're doing any mixing, what kind of choices we might make there, what we might do with equalization, how much treble and bass we want to hear, what we might be wanting to do with levels relative from cue to cue, how we might sequence things, how we might crossfade some cues together if we're going to do that. So some of that kind of falls into the domain of the producer. Some of it falls into the restoration activity. And I guess I kind of, in summary, see it a bit like the Mona Lisa. You've got this Leonardo da Vinci painting, and there might be an original of that that's kind of been sitting around in a dusty cupboard for 100 years or 200 years or something, and we pull it out and we need to look at it and assess it and try and work out how to bring it up to what it originally looked like, and very carefully and with an appreciation of what was originally done, try and reinstate that and get it back to how it was. As for mastering, that's the final chance to do something with the sonic character of material before a CD is pressed or vinyl is cut or a digital download is made available. And there's a bit of overlap sometimes with the restoration stuff there, because it's about, again, equalization choices. It's about whether or not we want any compression or limiting. So that's the idea of squishing down the loud bits or bringing up the quiet bits. Crossfades, track to track spacing, relative levels, those sorts of things. So it's kind of another set of ears, I guess, as well in mastering, where we have somebody that we trust, they'll listen to it for the first time and they might make some adjustments that we might otherwise miss because we're too close to the project or just because they're a different set of ears in a different environment. So in that case, again, thinking the Mona Lisa, it might be once the Mona Lisa is restored, it's where are we going to hang it in the museum? How are we going to light it so that everyone can enjoy it? And on some projects, I will take something all the way through. On other projects, we will take the restoration and provide that to an engineer like Doug Schwartz or James Nelson, who will do the mastering. And it kind of depends on project to project. It depends on the preferences of the producer. It depends on a whole number of things, I guess, but that's kind of how things end up working. And I think that's an important point for any of these film score projects that are produced, is that it's not the work of one person usually. It's the work of a whole heap of people that are working hard in an area that they are best suited to work in to do something. And so when you have somebody like Lucas Kendall, he's great at kind of liaising with the studio people and with all the people that he needs to work on something. So it's kind of like the general that's in charge of absolutely every process of ending up with a CD in your hand. So that's elements, it's studio people, it's paperwork, it's images, it's liner notes, it's all this sort of stuff, production stuff, it's remitting royalties. Every aspect of that might be something that he's got his hand in. Whereas for me, it's usually a very specific thing. It's focusing on, is the audio okay? Is that not okay? What can we do to bring it up to some sort of standard.
Thank you.
And that was, of course, the main title of the classic 1961 film Breakfast at Tiffany's. And this, I know, Chris, is a project that you really took a great deal of pleasure working on. So can we use Breakfast at Tiffany's as an example of the process you go through to remaster a classic score from the point where you have it sent down to you to when you finish your job working on the recordings?
I think what might be interesting to kind of tackle in this as well is a bit of what I'd call a potted Paramount history. So an idea of how things were done at Paramount, because I've done quite a few Golden Age and Silver Age scores for Paramount now. And I think they were a really interesting studio when it came to stereo for their films, but also how music was recorded. And this is largely around the studio sound chief was a guy called Loren Ryder. And he was one of the early adopters of magnetic film in post-production. So the idea of this 35mm sprocketed magnetic film, the stuff that used to run through projectors when we went to the cinema, but covered in a magnetic coating that we could record audio onto. So this was a technology that was, I think, demonstrated back in about 1948. But it was sometime in late 1950, early 1951, that Paramount got into using this. And prior to this point, all of the audio would have been recorded to what we call optical film, which are these sound wave squiggles on the side of a film. And that had a number of issues with it. And the main one was that it needed to be processed or developed before you could play it back, and arguably had an inferior sound quality. So Ryder was very much at the forefront of using magnetic film. And I think Columbia was the other studio that was kind of first on the bandwagon for this as well. But interestingly, one thing that Loren Ryder did not like was stereophonic sound. He felt that it really accentuated the idea of the picture editing. The idea that he thought stereo broke the illusion of us watching a film, and that we would notice the cuts in the sound, we'd notice the cuts in the picture, and it would kind of take us out of the viewing experience. So his concession to all this when the widescreen era started in the early 50s and the stereo sound era also started at the same time, he came up with a technology called Perspecta sound, something that Paramount really got into. And what that did is it had these low frequency control tones on the optical track, and it would steer the whole sound, so the dialogue, the music, and the effects together, grouped together in mono, and it would move it left or center or right of screen. So move the whole sound system around. And some people claim that it was an effective system, but it was nothing compared to the discrete stereo that we were getting out of the CinemaScope format from 20th Century Fox that had a magnetic sound. And that was really the forerunner to modern discrete stereo that we have in films today. But then the question is, well, how does this relate to music scoring at Paramount? Well, it impacts the way that the Paramount scoring stage was working. So by 1953, on the scoring stage, they were recording magnetic stereo in three channel, left, center, and right. And scores that I've worked on around that time actually have what we would recognize now as a pretty typical stereo spread. So you'd have the high strings on the left, the low strings on the right, the woodwinds up the middle, the brasses on the right, that sort of thing. The Naked Jungle, that's a soundtrack on the George Powell set for Entrada that was recorded pretty much that way. But then in the mid-1950s, it went to this idea of what they labeled three-head mono. So they were still recording on three channels, but each of the channels had the same thing on them, or potentially on one of them, a slightly different angle. And then in about 56, they moved to this idea of orchestra left, orchestra right, and then the third channel was usually just a replica of the orchestra left. The Ten Commandments is a score that was done that way. So not left, center, right, but just orchestra left, orchestra right. Several Victor Young scores were done that way as well that I can think of. And then into the 60s, and this is where we start to talk about scores like Breakfast at Tiffany's and Paris When It Sizzles, there's a different configuration again. And it was about grouping instruments so that when they did the dub or the re-recording of the film, when they laid the music into the film, they had options. And what we're really talking about here is that they put all of the strings, the high, so the violins, the violas, the cellos, the basses, all to channel one. And then channel two was all of the woodwinds, the piano, the percussion. And channel three was all of the brasses, the horns, the tuba, all of these. Any soloists also were usually on channel three. And so if we put all that on a CD in a just a left, center, right kind of spread out, it would sound really, really weird, especially in a situation where there might not be any brass instruments or woodwinds playing. So you can think of passages of music where it might just be the strings, because as we know, the Golden Age scores were probably a bit more heavy on strings than they are these days. That would all be just coming out the left side. So you'd hear all the violins and the basses and all the strings grouped together on the left. And it would kind of sound really weird. And there would be no other kind of ambience to the sound. And that is kind of unpleasant to listen to. But it also comes about because Paramount really tightly mic'd the brass, which is kind of interesting. And I quite like a closely mic'd brass. But it meant that there wasn't much else that was bleeding through if they had the brass mics on. The reason they did this was it was all about options when they laid the music into the film. If the director or the mixers at the time thought, oh, look, the strings are too loud, they could bring the strings down. Or if somebody thought, hey, look, we don't want to hear the woodwinds, they could almost eliminate them entirely by just dialing down that track. It was nothing to do with stereo records, because none of these film soundtracks of the era were really put onto stereo records. It was re-recorded. It was all about how do you best service the film in terms of its sound. So Breakfast at Tiffany's, how that fits into this is, well, I mean, firstly, what an honor to do it. An Academy Award winner. And one, when you listen to the Entrada album, you really get a sense of how gifted Henry Mancini was as a composer of dramatic underscore. In a way, he did himself a disservice, and he mentioned this himself in his latter years, of making all these easy listening records where he'd put on all the kind of the source music pieces and he'd leave out the dramatic underscore. So he kind of became known for that. But I know from some research that he really wished he'd put on some more of that dramatic underscore at times. And at Breakfast at Tiffany's in particular, he'd wished that he'd put the Audrey Hepburn vocal on his soundtrack LP. And look, for whatever reason, he wasn't able to use the Paramount recordings at the time. But what was interesting about this to me is that this score came to me when I was holidaying in Australia's Whitsunday Islands off the coast of Queensland. I was on holiday and an email came in from Lucas that said, hey, do you want to work on Breakfast at Tiffany's? Here's a download link to the Elements. And even though I was on holiday, I thought, you know what, I've got to hear these things. So I downloaded them using my phone, using smartphone, mobile or cellular data to listen to them. And you know, that probably cost me a fortune, probably cost me as much as the holiday. I don't know, I didn't look back on my phone bill, but that's how I was so keen to listen to what this stuff was that that's how I downloaded it. And Lucas basically said, look, here's the Elements. I know you love the score because I'd mentioned it to him before. And he said, you know, I'll basically leave you to turn in some sort of album from this. And if it's horrible, then, hey, that might be the end of things. But, you know, see how you go. I guess it kind of speaks to Lucas as a producer. I think he's very good at worrying about the detail he needs to worry about and kind of letting others do what he's entrusted them to do. So it means he's not a micromanager, but it means he's also not totally hands off. He's got this perfect balance. And I guess I admire that and I enjoy working with him because it means I'm able to kind of get on and do what I need to do. And he's able to see both the big picture and the small picture in a project. And it all kind of works pretty well. But that element, the Breakfast at Tiffany's element, was exactly like I was talking about before. The idea of it being three channels, but all the strings were on channel one, all the woodwinds on channel two, all the brasses on channel three. And just a left, center, right pan across the stereo soundstage didn't sound very nice. So the main thing there is to kind of set yourself up so that you can hear some of the strings. You can split the strings out via some processing and kind of spread them out a bit more. That's the main trick with those. And that's how that came about. It was just a process of finding a methodology that kind of worked. And then when it did, trying it out, and everyone seemed happy with it. So that was it. No rework necessary.
Thank you.
That was music from the classic 1961 film Breakfast at Tiffany's, with visual music composed and conducted by Henry Mancini and remastered for the Intrada release by my guest Chris Malone. And with that, we've come to the end of part one of this interview with Chris Malone. I do hope you have enjoyed what you have heard so far. Join us again very soon for part two of my interview with Chris. But until then, for me, Jason Drury, is take care and happy listening.
Thank you for listening to Cinematic Sound Radio. I want to thank Tim Burden for providing his voice for all the bumpers and stingers you hear throughout the program, and David Cassina for providing Cinematic Sound Radio's theme music. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, please email us at cinematicsound@yahoo.com. You can find us on social media at CinSound Radio on Twitter and Cinematic Sound on Facebook. And if you listen to us on Apple Podcasts, please take a moment right now to rate and review the show. It really helps us rise through the ranks and helps potential new listeners find the show. And don't forget to check out Cinematic Sound Radio at cinematicsound.net.